Joe Land Company, in cooperation with the Subliminal Research Foundation, presents The Psychology of Weight Loss. Recently, Joe Land conducted a lecture for a group of people who shared a common problem. They were overweight and unable to do anything about it. Frankly, he told them some pretty startling things. He provided them with exciting insights that generate a great deal of new hope toward understanding the overweight problem. Like them, you'll be surprised at some of the hidden reasons and motivations for overeating. Listen now as our founder and chairman speaks on the psychology of weight loss.
I want you to know that I'm not going to speak to you tonight primarily from book learning. I'm going to speak to you as one of you because I've had a weight problem all my life. In fact, it's been the biggest problem that I've ever faced. It's consumed more energy, more effort. It's been more frustrating, more consuming than any other problem or goal that I've ever tackled. I've been, well, I admit to being 60 pounds heavier than I am tonight, and I was at 230 pounds for a long, long time. I faced some things inside me. Once I found out what the real problem was, then controlling my weight became much, much easier. And I found that most people who are overweight don't know why they're overweight. And I think you'll agree with me when we get through this evening. I'm going to tell you some reasons that you're overweight that you don't know about, but I can convince you, and you'll agree with those reasons when we get through with this evening. I think you'll have a whole new perspective on the whole thing. I think you'll see that you've been fighting an enemy that you couldn't find. You really don't know where the culprit is or what the real problem is, and we fight not knowing where to fight or how to fight. And we'll at least know where the battle is when we get through with this evening. Let me begin, if I can, by telling you why people are overweight. People are overweight because they eat too much. Now, folks, the problem isn't any more complicated than that. Now, why they eat too much, that's a different story, and that's extremely complex, most complicated. But the fact that we eat too much is the reason that some 40% of America is overweight. And this is the toughest thing I'm going to say to you all night. I may as well get this over with. It gets better from this point forward. Ladies and gentlemen, the real problem, the reason that America is overweight, the reason that we have such a tremendous problem with excess fat on our bodies is that we are food abusers. If you eat more food than your body can use as fuel, the excess is food abuse. We live in a society that's put food in a high predominant place. We entertain with food. We celebrate with food. We comfort with food. We show our love with food. We accept love with food. We use food for all kinds of things except providing fuel for our body. In fact, we've lost sight of the fact as a society what food's all about and what it's for. You see, the real problem is not that we eat too much. The problem is that we've lost control. The problem is that we are addicted to food, and we can't stay away from it. We can't control food. Food controls us. And if you don't believe that, I want you to just think back to the last 10 or 12 times you went on a diet and swore to yourself that you were going to take dominion over food, that you were only going to eat those foods that were non-fattening, and you were going to eat very little of them, and you were going to get slim and trim so you could be happy, healthy, and attractive. Remember all those times? What happened? The food took control. The terrible thing about having to lose weight and keep it off, it's not something that you do. You see, no matter how tough it is, we can work up our nerve and grit our teeth and do about anything. But you don't lose weight by doing something. You lose weight by not doing something. And you have to not do it 24 hours a day. And folks, in case you haven't noticed, time is working against you. Time is on food's side. If you can't gain control over food 100% of the time, if you can't change your relationship with food, then there isn't any way to maintain a healthy, normal-looking body. And I'm here to tell you this evening that diets don't work, folks. And I'll tell you why they don't work. They don't work because by the very definition of a diet, what we're doing is that we're denying ourselves the things that we love. And all the time we're doing that, we're dreaming about those things that we love that we're not able to eat. And we're living for one day. And every day the feeling gets more intense. And what we're waiting for is that wonderful, marvelous day when we reach the ideal weight we're looking for, so we can go back to eating all those foods we love. And that's why we gain all the weight. And so what we have to understand is what the problem is. Ladies and gentlemen, the problem of obesity is not a physical problem. Obesity, extra body weight on our bodies, is not the problem. It's the result of the problem. The problem is a mental one. And I'd like, if I can, for just a moment, talk a little bit about the human mind, because if that's where the problem is, if we can gain a better understanding of how our minds work and what the problem is within our mind, then we've got a much better chance of solving the problem. This business about conscious versus subconscious mind. We don't have two minds, and when they talk about conscious and subconscious, they simply are dividing the mind up into two operations. That part of your mind that operates with your awareness and that part that operates without your awareness. The conscious mind, that part of your mind that you are aware of, is really the only part that we know about. Conscious, meaning we're conscious of what happens in there. It's where we think. It's where we make our decisions. It's where we feel our emotions. It's where we structure our sentences and think of words as we're about to make conversation with people. Like I say, it's the part of our mind that we're aware of. And as far as we're concerned, that's really all there is to our mind. But that's the smallest part of your mind. And the conscious mind is the smallest part and the most feeble part of your mind. You know, the conscious mind can only do one thing at a time. You can only think one thought at a time. Your subconscious mind, on the other hand, that part of your mind that operates without your awareness, can do thousands of things simultaneously. It's in charge of operating the vital organs of the body. It makes your heart pump. It makes your lungs work. It's in charge of motor activity. As I do things with my hand, I am not remotely aware of how it happens. It's almost like I just wish it, and it does it. My subconscious mind has been programmed, has been trained to pull all those hundreds of muscles and tendons that it takes to operate my body, and it does it very well, but it does it without my knowledge, without my awareness. I don't even know how it does it. And the subconscious mind also serves as the human data bank. It's that part of our minds that records and stores information. Brain is an electrochemical device. It is an extremely sophisticated, very complex machine that can be likened in many ways to a computer. And like a computer, it has a memory storage bank in the subconscious mind. All of the stimuli that comes in from our five senses is stored in our subconscious mind. And it serves as our frame of reference for all of the rest of the life we live. The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, that the human being is the most programmable animal on the face of the earth. Why are we more programmable than any other animal? Because our computer banks and our ability to take on and store and use information is much more sophisticated than any other animal we know of. And so the more information we take on and store, the more life we live, the more little slices of life that we put in there, the more we permanently change ourselves, because it serves as the data and the frame of reference that we live our life by. I had a psychiatrist one time explain the conscious and the subconscious mind in a way that I thought was really interesting and really understandable. He said, "Joe, I want you to imagine a room. Now, that room is a storage room, and it's going to be your subconscious mind. In that room is stored everything you've ever experienced, everything you've thought, everything you've seen, heard, smelled, tasted, felt, or did. It's all in that room. Now, I want you to imagine a guard standing outside the door of that room. That's your conscious mind. Now, the guard appears to be in charge. If you ask the guard a question, then he'll give you the answer. If you ask for a decision, it'll be the guard that decides and gives you the answer. And so we think the guard's in charge, but he's not, because the guard can only make a decision one way. That's by using the information in his storage room that provides his total frame of reference, because that's where his emotions come from, that's where his feelings come from, that's where his opinions come from, it's where his attitudes come from, his priorities, his preferences. Even the way he thinks comes from that room. And so we wander around this world thinking that our conscious mind, that little portion of our mind, about 12% of it that we are aware of, is in control. But when we try to do things with just the conscious mind, we find that it falls way, way short. It's our subconscious mind and the programming contained in our subconscious mind, lessons that it's learned that we've consciously forgotten years ago, that really control us to a tremendous, tremendous degree. Now, I've said that to say this. The good news I have for you this evening is that, folks, you can stop beating yourself up for not having any willpower. And I know how that works because I did it for years. I would decide that I wanted to go on a diet, and then I would decide which diet. It'd be a very rigid one. I'd have some unrealistic goal and some unrealistic diet to go with it so that I could lose the weight in a month and a half. And I'd start that diet, and then 2 or 3 days in, I would lack the willpower, lose the willpower, fall off the diet, my self-esteem would go down, I'd eat more food than I had missed during the little brief period of time that I dieted, and that cycle went on and on and on, and every time I called myself that much more of a failure, every time I was down on myself because I didn't have any willpower. You must be a terribly weak person, Joe, because you can't even stay away from the food just because it tastes good. And I went on that for years and years and years, but ladies and gentlemen, I was wrong. And you're wrong to beat yourself up over willpower, because willpower doesn't have anything to do with your weight problem. Did you know that? It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that you're overweight. Let me tell you what really happens. You go in a restaurant, and you sit down at a table, and you open up the menu, and you hear two voices. One voice says, "Look over here at the Dieter's Delight." The other voice says, "Never mind the Dieter's Delight. They got a sale this month on chicken fried steak. Look here, the special is chicken fried steak, got mashed potatoes, cream gravy, side bowl of red beans, and got free dessert." Now, you're having a conflict, aren't you? Well, what do? We make a decision. We make a decision. How do we make a decision? We always make a decision the same way. All of us make a decision the same way. You get good and familiar with the two alternatives. You throw them back in that thing we call our subconscious mind, and we run it around our priorities and our preferences that are contained from a lifetime of programming. That's where the decision is made. The true priorities and true preferences take over, and out pops the decision. Chicken fried steak. Now, folks, that didn't have anything to do with willpower. It had to do with priorities. It had to do what was really most important to you. You see, you didn't just tell the world that you don't have any willpower. You just told the world that when push comes to shove, when we get back into the back recesses of your mind where your programming controls you, when we get to the preferences and priorities and the real attitudes, the food was more important than you were. Doesn't that make sense? You're just simply expressing your true, honest feelings. You're not doing something you don't want to do. You're doing exactly what you want to do. But you're doing what that part of you that controls you wants to do, no matter what you think consciously. Because anytime you get into a battle between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind is going to win, ladies and gentlemen. You've seen it happen thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And if you think that the diet is more important than the food, and your subconscious mind thinks the food's more important than the diet, then guess what happens? Doesn't have anything to do with willpower. Forget about that. The fact of the matter is that we have been programmed with an entire relationship with food. And I want you to remember that phrase, because that's what it is. You have a relationship with food, and it is more encompassing than fuel. It doesn't have anything to do with providing nutrition for your body, because we as an abundant society have invented a tremendous relationship with food. And as I told you a minute ago, we use it for everything from entertainment to celebration to holidays to vacations. Food is fun. It's our friend. It's a neat way to live your life until it becomes your enemy. And so what I'd like to do is show you what a lifetime of programming in a country that's built around food has done in the deep recesses of your subconscious mind that results in overeating, a lack of control over that portion of your behavior, and an obesity problem that is a tremendous problem in this country. There are three basic categories of reasons that we overeat or that we can't gain control over our eating. And I want to talk to you about all three of them. First one is a conscious set of reasons. We're aware of them. It's the set that you're aware of and have been aware of for a long time. It's the ones you've been trying to fight. I call it recreational eating. We've made a pastime out of eating in this country. We've made cooking an art form. Boy, we're good at it. We found out that food tastes wonderful, and we have the affluence and the abundance to make it taste even better. We've refined sugars, and we've learned how to make confectionery things, and we put people on a pedestal who are wonderful, marvelous cooks. You know, if something provides a tremendous amount of pleasure, it also provides a tremendous amount of control. You see, that's the problem with the cocaine addict. Cocaine, they tell me, is not physically addictive. But if you find someone who's hooked on cocaine, you'll see that they are psychologically addicted to cocaine. And if you ask them why, and they're honest to you, they will tell you that it makes them feel so wonderful they can't give it up. And it therefore takes control of them. I had an old preacher one time after church tell me something that I never will forget. I don't remember how the conversation came up. But he said, "Joe, the problem with sin is that it's fun." That makes sense to you? We wouldn't have a problem with sin if it wasn't fun. And the problem with food, folks, is that it's wonderful. It's wonderful. In 1957, when the American Medical Association had their annual convention that year, that's the year they formally declared alcoholism a disease. And they didn't have any argument about whether or not to declare it a disease. The argument and all the discussion that year came over what the symptoms of this new disease was. Because doctors like to have a symptom if they're going to treat a disease. And they, after much debate, decided that the primary symptom for alcoholism was if the patient had tried to alter their drinking and couldn't. If they tried to stop drinking or tried to diminish their drinking and failed, they're an alcoholic. And if you take that simple addictive formula and apply that symptom to food, we see that some 35 to 40% of America is addicted to food for the very same reason that that the cocaine addict is addicted to cocaine. You see, our bodies are perfectly capable of regulating the kind and amount of food that we eat. It's instinctive. It's built into us. You see, once we reprogram ourselves to eat for pleasure, for fun, for recreation, instead of to provide fuel for our body, then we begin to override all those natural mechanisms that we have in this tremendous apparatus we call our bodies, and food then begins to control us. And we have absolute programmed eating in this country. What do you have when you go to a ball game? Hot dog. What do you have when you go to the show? Popcorn. What do you have when you go to the fair? Cotton candy. You know, we build our vacations around food. Holidays. Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is when we pile more food on the table than we could conceivably eat, and then we proceed to eat it anyway. And then we have delighted our palates and satisfied our mouths to such an extent that our poor stomachs are stretched all out of shape. We're miserable. We're sick. We're laying on the floor groaning. And we all do the same thing. We're laying there. We hurt. And we all do the same thing. That's when we decide to go on a diet. Because, you see, now we've satisfied our number one priority, all that pleasure we get out of food. And for the moment, we've got this other priority that pops up. And this little tiny voice says, "What about the dieter's delight? What about the skinny body?" And you go, "All right. Boy, enough is enough of this. I'm going on a diet now." And that lasts until tomorrow at noon when our true priorities come back into focus. And now we'd rather be fat than be this hungry. You see? That's the way it works. That's the way it works. It's not anything mystical. Boy, we live in a society that treats food like the biggest recreation we have, and we are paying the price. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the way your family treated food will determine how you treat food, because remember, we're programmed. Let me see if I can't prove that to you. They say that if you have two thin parents, there's only a 10% chance you're going to be overweight. If you have one heavy parent, then your chances just popped up to 40%. And if you have two parents who are overweight, 80% chance you're going to be overweight. Yeah, but Joe, doesn't that have to do with genetics? Doesn't that have to do with hereditary things? Well, you might have inherited your metabolism from your parents, but remember, all metabolism does is decide how much we can eat before we gain weight. Everybody in here has a different metabolism, and everybody in here, therefore, has a different tolerance, so a different amount of food that you can eat that provides fuel. And so no matter what your metabolism is, if you eat more than it takes to run your body, you're a food abuser, and that's not a physical hereditary problem. That's a programming problem. That's a psychological problem, ladies and gentlemen. And when your parents use food for recreation, you're going to learn it from a very early age, and you're not just going to learn it here. You're going to learn it back here in that part of your mind that really controls you when it comes time to decide what you're going to have to eat today. The worst thing that can happen to a recreational eater is that food becomes the biggest single pleasure in their life. And folks, if you don't think you're there, you might ought to think about it seriously, because I have been there. I've been to the place where food was the most pleasure I knew. It was the one thing that I looked forward to more than anything else that I did. And there's only one little step from food being the biggest pleasure in your life to it being your only pleasure. You see, there are people who have been engaged in recreational eating so long and gotten so huge and felt so bad about themselves, and as they do, as that program progressed, they would step back further and further from society and from relationships and from the other things we get from people, and food became king. Food became everything to them. And folks, when food is the only pleasure in your life, it's a sad, sad life. I told you that was conscious. We know we're doing that, but somehow we keep on doing it because it's such a tremendous pleasure and we don't know what to replace it with. Everybody in here is going to go on that big diet one of these days, and you all know what I'm talking about. You know, the one where you're going to have one celery stick a day for 6 months until your friends all think you're anorexic, right? Everybody's going to go on that diet one of these days. None of us know when we're going to go on it, but we do know when we're not going to go on it, don't we? We're not going to go on it now. Now we're going to have the chicken fried steak. The second set of reasons that people overeat, I call semi-conscious. That is, you're not aware of why you're eating when you're eating. But when I talk about them this evening, you're going to say, yeah, he's right. I do that. And I was introduced to this particular concept by a young lady that I interviewed, and I don't have the footage. We weren't taping that interview, but it was one of the most interesting I've had. She was, let me describe her to you. She was a beautiful young lady. She didn't have a weight problem to look at her. Although she tells me that her weight gets away from her every now and then, and she gains 10 or 15 pounds, she gained more than that, 30 or 35 pounds at one point in her life, and was able to pull it back. And she realizes she has a problem. She classifies herself as having an eating problem. And when I asked her what her problem was, when I said, well, okay, what's your problem in your opinion? Why do you have a problem with eating? She said something very interesting. She said, when my husband doesn't pay a lot of attention to me. Apparently, he worked a lot and was gone in the evenings a lot and took trips. And when she was neglected, when he didn't pay enough attention to her, she said she ate a lot of chocolate. Now, I thought, that's really interesting. I believe I'll, you know, delve a little further into this and find out what this means. And after 15 or 20 minutes, I finally found the whole story. And it's not only interesting, but it's classic. It happens over and over and over and over again, and I think you'll find that most people who have a problem with overeating, most people who don't have control over food, not only have one of these problems, but have all three of them, because they're all so interconnected. Here's what her story really was. This young lady loves chocolate. Eating chocolate is bliss for her. It's ecstasy. There's nothing that she knows to do that feels any better than eating chocolate. But you see, her priorities are in their proper place, because she knows the chocolate makes her heavy. She's not willing to give up her young and beautiful body, and so her priorities being in the proper place, just barely in place, but being in place, the body takes priority over the chocolate. She keeps the chocolate in check. She stays away from it the vast majority of the time and normally doesn't have a weight problem. But when her husband neglects her, when he doesn't pay enough attention to her, she starts to feel insecure. And her insecurity, if left alone, quickly changes to a mild form of depression. Now she's having emotional problems. And if that situation persists and gets bad enough, she's having an emotional crisis. She's having a terrible day. She's having a problem. She hurts emotionally. And if it's left that in that situation long enough and the pain gets bad enough, she starts to look for some relief. And she goes to that one surefire pleasure center that is so wonderful, it's guaranteed to make her feel better no matter what the situation is. And that's when she makes the move for the chocolate. You know what that's called? That's called being emotionally dependent on food. You see, ladies and gentlemen, that's using food as a mood-altering substance. That's like taking drugs. That's like the alcoholic who uses an outside substance, something that they put in their mouth to make themselves feel better emotionally, to alter their mood. That's as addictive as any kind of personality there ever was. And it's classic. So many people eat for emotional reasons. And it's not just when they're insecure. They eat when they're lonely, when they're bored, when they're depressed, when they've got any kind of anxiety, insecurity, so on. The list is as long as bad emotions are. And every one of those emotions takes us to the food. Why? Because we're programmed that way. When a baby's born, the first day, we start the programming the first day. When a baby is born and we put it down in its little crib for the first time and the nurse lets it go and the baby has a little insecurity, some fear sets in, and it starts to cry, what do? Well, we stick a bottle in its mouth, of course. In other words, little baby, have the first of many lessons in solving emotional problems with food. We're going to calm you with food now, and because there's something about the mouth. You know, Freud called the first 18 months of a baby's life the oral phase. There's something about the mouth that satisfies. We all know the term oral gratification. We don't really understand it, yet we do kind of understand it because there's something special about our mouths. You see, eating is the most private, the most personal thing we do. It's when we take an innate object from out here in the world and we pass it through the portals of our mouth and we incorporate it into us and make it a part of our beings. You see, there's some powerful medicine there. I was in a store the other day, and I promise this happened just the way I'm about to describe it. I am not enhancing it a drop. I was in this store, and I had my little number, and I was waiting to go to the checkout stand, and all of us were standing around with our little numbers. And there was a lady, she was overweight, and she had about a 15 or 16-year-old daughter, and she was overweight. And she had, I would guess, an 18-month-old little girl, little baby girl in diapers. She was sitting in the kitty chair in the back of the shopping cart. Well, we hadn't been there long, and this little 18-month-old baby gets pretty fed up with that store and with the shopping cart and with life in general and whatever, and starts to cry. And that was more like a fit. She's bellowing at the top of her lungs, and she hadn't been doing that 10 seconds when the mother turned to the older daughter and said, "Get out the raisins." The older daughter reaches in, gets out a little tiny green box of raisins, pours some out on her hand, puts them out in front of the little child, and the little kid just keeps on screaming. She says, "Oh, you want to take them out of the box, don't you? See, we've done this before." She puts them back in the box and gives the box to the little kid. The little kid has its head thrown back, screaming and yelling. He gets a hold of the raisins and he goes, "There we go. There you go, little girl. Have one more lesson in the lifelong saga you're programming, solving emotional problems with food." You see, little Tommy falls down and hurts his knee. What do? Give him a cookie. He goes to school, makes an A, we give him two cookies. You see, and if you don't believe, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't believe that that kind of activity, doing those kinds of seemingly innocent things with little children, have a lifelong effect on them, you're wrong. Let me give you an example. You would think that the child of an alcoholic would be the last person in the world to ever drink. Growing up in the horror of an alcoholic home, seeing the terrible things that happen as a result of alcoholism, you would think that the child of an alcoholic would be the last one in the world to ever have a drink, much less become an alcoholic. But we know that the overwhelming majority of the children of alcoholics become alcoholics. Why? Programming. They've been programmed. They've seen that lifestyle from the very beginning. Ever since that little tiny room was fresh and new and precious and unprotected, the person that was the ultimate authority figure, my security, my parents. You know, a lot of us are 10, 12, 15 years old before we find out our parents are not perfect. And we think they're perfect back then. And in our early years, the ones that the programming is the most powerful, we see these lifestyles and we emulate them for the rest of our lives long after we've consciously forgotten what we see. Those programs play and play and play. And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't realize that you are the sum total to a tremendous degree of the experiences that you've had in your life up until now, and that you unconsciously emulate people and things and situations that you've seen since birth, then you need to stop and think again, because you're not who you think you are. You think you're uniquely you, but you, in fact, are a composite of all the programming that's in your subconscious mind and all the feelings and the attitudes and the data that you're fed from that subconscious mind without even realizing why you do those things. But here's the most devastating part of this emotional eating process of all. You see, when I'm depressed and when I'm insecure and I'm lonely, I don't say, I'm depressed and I'm insecure and I'm lonely and therefore I'm going to go get me a cheeseburger and make myself feel better. We don't say that to ourselves. We say, I'm insecure and depressed and lonely and, you know, I'm also hungry. I believe I'm going to go get myself something to eat. Because, you see, we don't think we're solving emotional problems. We think we're hungry. You know why? Because the subconscious mind makes us think we're hungry. You see, you're fighting an entity that has some powers you don't have. The subconscious has the ability to fool you, and you don't have the ability to fool it. It's been fooled by years of programming, and it's going to impose that programming on you whether you like it or not. Let me give you an example, if I can. Smokers. Do you know why smokers gain weight when they quit smoking? I've heard all these excuses. Well, it changes your body chemistry, and the food tastes better after you... No, that's not it. Let me tell you what the problem is. It's this oral thing. It's this business of solving our emotional problems and calming ourselves with our mouths. You see, smokers solve their emotional problems and their anxieties by puffing. And when you take that cigarette away, their emotions are exposed. Why, they don't have any way to fight them. And what do? They try to find something else to stick in their mouth. That's the way it works. And so they eat all this food, and that's why they gain weight. But let me give you an idea of how powerful the subconscious is and how much it controls us. Let me talk to you about how smokers get programmed. And I can speak with authority on this subject because I smoked for years too. We have someone who's a smoker. He's engaged in a conversation, an intense debate. Boy, this is really fascinating, and he's got his conscious mind absolutely wrapped up in this conversation. And he's right in the middle of making a point that'll no doubt save the world. And at that very moment, unbeknown to him, a little bit of anxiety pops into his subconscious mind. See, your subconscious mind gets anxiety just like your conscious mind does. He doesn't have time to mess with it, so the anxiety goes into his subconscious. The subconscious first starts to classify that feeling and compare it with other feelings that it's had, and it identifies it as anxiety. Now, it starts to look for an appropriate response to this anxiety. Suicide. No, not that much anxiety. Get drunk. No, I haven't got time for that. Smoke a cigarette. Now, folks, this is what's scary. This man's subconscious mind just made a decision. And he doesn't know it. It decided to meet this anxiety with smoking a cigarette. And so without notifying him at all that there is an anxiety or that he's going to have a cigarette, the subconscious throws the program into effect. The program is right hand goes into left front shirt pocket. And if the cigarettes are there, he'll pull them out. If his lighter's where the program thinks it is, he will light up his cigarette, pull over an ashtray, puff, flip ashes, puff, flip ashes, until it's through, and he'll put it out and never knew he smoked a cigarette. If the cigarette package isn't there, then program starts. Right hand in the left shirt pocket. And it may feel around in there for a minute and a half, you know. I mean, there is nothing in there. But he's talking away, and, you know, he's listening, and he does not know that he's doing this. And he'll just do it for... Finally, when the program decides there are no cigarettes in this pocket, it'll maybe go to an alternate pocket. If he's really enough involved in the conversation, it's liable to go to three or four pockets. Once the program decides there are no cigarettes, then the program is aborted and an alarm is sent to the conscious mind. We are out of cigarettes. And he has to deal with that on a conscious level because his program will not take him to 7-Eleven to get some more. Now, that's powerful, ladies and gentlemen. This man didn't know he had anxiety and didn't know he was going to have a cigarette. And if he hadn't run out of cigarettes, he'd have never found out about it. And you see, that same program works against you when it comes time to eat for emotional reasons because the anxiety comes up into the subconscious mind. Whoops, we got a problem. What do we do? Eat. That's what we've been programmed to do. Go stick some ice cream in our mouths. That always makes us feel better. That'll alter our mood. But the subconscious doesn't say, hey, conscious mind, why don't you solve this emotional problem by eating? Because you'd say, hey, Joel Land said I shouldn't do that. And so it's much more clever than that. It knows how to get you to eat. All it has to do is send you a false hunger signal. I did a lot of study on hunger and the symptoms of hunger because I wanted to be able to tell you folks how to recognize real bodily hunger from psychological or mouth hunger. And you know something? There isn't any difference. It all comes from the same place. And you see, the recreational eater and the emotional eater get those hunger signals all the time. That's why you think about food all the time. That's why you can't get it out of your mind. And that's why it plagues you until you go off your diet. Because your subconscious is continually feeding you thoughts that you don't want to have. Now, that's power, ladies and gentlemen. You can't fight that, not on a conscious level. You see, we use food for lots of destructive things, too. And it takes some really strange forms. I found some people that, looking back on their problem, saw that they used their fat as an excuse for failure. And the way that works is this. I maybe am not as social as I'd like to be. I haven't accomplished as much as I'd like to accomplish. Maybe I don't feel people think as much of me as I'd like for them to. And I've decided that that's much easier to live with if I decide that the fat is the reason. And so the fact that I'm fat is the reason that I'm not successful, that I fail in those areas. And you see, if you convince the subconscious mind that the fat is the reason, then it will keep the fat there, so you'll always have the reason, because deep down, psychologically, they're afraid that after the fat's gone, they will still be failures. And so now there's a subconscious reason for me to keep myself fat, and it's perfectly able to order up enough chicken fried steaks to do that. I talk to people who use their fat to avoid relationships and to avoid sex and to avoid that kind of social intimate contact with other human beings. They use the fat to keep them away from that so they didn't have to deal with that. Fat serves as a padding to keep you from getting hurt by the outside world by a great number of people. And a tremendous number of people eat to hurt other people. You know, if you have someone, maybe your husband or your wife, that is continually after you to lose weight, every time you get mad at them, what do? You go and stuff your mouth full of food. In fact, most of us, when we get mad at ourselves, go to the refrigerator to punish somebody, and there isn't anyone to punish, folks, but us in that kind of situation. And the worst thing that can happen to an emotional eater is that food becomes their best friend. I mean, after all, it never criticizes you, never condemns you. It's always there for you, and it always just does one thing. It provides you with an abundance of pleasure. It understands and makes you feel better when nobody else can, even when nobody else is there. And by the time these people realize that food is not their best friend, in fact, it's not even a friend at all, that it is indeed their worst enemy, many times it's too late. And there isn't any way of getting out of that trap unless you can find a way to undo the damage that's been done back in that portion of your mind that really controls your behavior, including your eating behavior. And the third set of reasons is totally unconscious. And they're the most devastating at all, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you that there's an entire group of reasons that you eat that you're totally unaware of. And if you're unaware of them, how are you going to fight the battle? How are you going to try to win against an enemy you can't identify and you can't see operating? An enemy as formidable as that huge portion of your mind we call the unconscious or the subconscious mind. Because, you see, the subconscious mind can be your best friend if it's programmed properly, or it can be your absolute most devastating enemy if it is not programmed properly. And most of us don't know who our biggest enemy is because it dwells within our minds. And it relates to our self-image. You see, your self-image is the most precious commodity you own. It's the most important single base of information contained in your memory bank, in your room. It's your picture of yourself. It's what you really, on a subconscious level, the sum total of that programming results in what you think you are and who you think you are. And you see, we become what we think about. The Bible says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, and there were never any truer words ever spoken. Because your actions that result from the attitudes, feelings, opinions, and priorities from your subconscious mind that are a result of your self-image control your behavior, and it's behavior that is purposely poised to make you into what the mind believes you are, or to keep you the way it perceives you should be. Now, what does self-image have to do with being overweight? Well, it has everything to do with being overweight, because you see, ladies and gentlemen, you will not gain any more weight than your self-image will accept. Now, think about that for a minute. You cannot, you will not gain any more weight. Your body will not get any bigger than your self-image will accept. If you are a fat person in your self-image, then your behavior is going to be the behavior of a fat person, because, remember, our behavior will always be in conformity to what our self-image is. Let me see if I can't prove that to you. I don't know anything about who won Miss America this year. But I want to talk about a hypothetical Miss America pageant winner. Let's imagine that the Miss America pageant was being held tonight, and let's talk about the beautiful, young, talented woman who wins it. Now, she's got a wonderful self-image. How do I know? Because you don't even enter the Miss America pageant unless you've got a tremendous self-image, and you certainly don't have the confidence and the poise to walk out on that stage and capture the heart of America if you don't have a healthy self-image. She wins that contest that night, and let's follow her home. She comes home, and she feels so good about herself. She takes that crown off of her head and looks at it one final time and puts it on the dresser, gets ready for bed, and gets in bed and goes to sleep. Now, let's invent a hypothetical disease that's going to strike her tonight. She is going to get a disease called the gain 50 pounds overnight disease. Right there in bed, while she's sleeping, overnight, she gains 50 pounds. Now, think about this and visualize this with me. She wakes up the next morning, and she looks in the mirror. And what happens next? Blood-curdling scream. Devastation. Trauma. This is the most horrible thing that's ever happened to her. She won't get out of the house. She won't let anybody see her. She won't let her dog see her. Will she go on a diet? Will she go on a diet? This woman will not look at food for 3 months. Cheesecake, hamburgers. You talking about cheesecake and hamburgers at a time like this? Look at my body. Look at what has happened to me. She's absolutely beyond reason. Her emotions have run away with her. Why? Why such a violent reaction to 50 pounds? Because the image in the mirror doesn't match her self-image. And you see, that mismatch causes her some real disturbance. Now, there's motivation, ladies and gentlemen. She's motivated. She's not going to have a problem staying on her diet. You can't get her to eat. On the other hand, the woman who lives next door is also 50 pounds overweight. When she wakes up and looks in the mirror, she goes, Why the difference? Because her 50 pounds came 1 pound at a time, over a long period of years. And she had a chance to gradually get used to it and succumb to it, and her self-image accepted it, one notch at a time. Let me tell you what I call the psychological thermostat. And I don't know how yours works, but I can tell you how mine worked for years. For a long time, I was hung between 180 and 185. And I weigh every morning. My weight is almost an obsession to me, and it has been for a long time. I weigh every morning of the world. I got these doctor scales that'll weigh you within an ounce of what you really weigh. And the mornings that I would climb up on the... Remember time? When I'd climb up on the scale some morning and it would read 185, somewhere in the back of my mind, I'd panic. And boy, the resolve would well up in me, and I would decide that instant. I don't care if I'm planning to have somebody over for supper tonight. I don't care if it's the county fair tomorrow. I don't care if I'm leaving on vacation this morning. I'm going on a diet. And I did. And I always had the same thing in mind. 175. Never got there, but that's where I was going. I want to go to 175. Like to go 160. Like to have anorexia. Like to blow away, but I'd settle for 175. And boy, my determination is right there. But you know, I'd start that rigid, restrictive diet, and 4, 5, 6 days later, I'd climb up on the scales one morning, and it would say 180. And something in the back of my mind would go, whew, thank God. That was my thermostat. You see, 185 was not acceptable to my self-image, but 180 apparently was. My conscious mind thought I wanted 175, but when I looked in the mirror and said 175, my self-image said, nah, 180's okay. See, that's why when you look in the mirror and say, my God, I've got to take off this weight, your self-image says, how come? Looks okay to me. Robs us of our motivation. Robs us of... Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, a person with a fat self-image, way back in the part of their mind that controls their behavior, that decides what to order off that menu, thinks you deserve to be fat. Thinks you should be fat. Thinks it's norm. Thinks it's okay. It's accepted it. That's why when you look at pictures, those of you who have lost weight or who used to be heavier than you are now, you've got pictures of you real heavy. I do. And when I look at those pictures, I go, surely I wasn't that fat. But you know, that picture hasn't changed. You know what's changed? The acceptance level, the fat acceptance level contained in my self-image, in my subconscious mind. I didn't look that bad then. Why? Because I was lying to myself. Because that was acceptable. It doesn't look bad because it isn't all that bad. You see, that's what happens. You look in the mirror and you see that reflection through the acceptability of your self-image. And you say, well, that isn't all that bad. Wrong. It is all that bad, but you've accepted it. You see, food becomes more important than you are. And folks, that's a self-image problem. Well, that's the problems that we have to deal with. You see, it's much, much stronger than just food tastes good. We have things that go on within our mind as a result of the programming that we've received up until this part of our life. Those things that are stored in our room, those attitudes, those beliefs, those feelings about food, our entire relationship with food and what we use it for, even the destructive things we use it for, are there, continually influencing us. And if we don't find a way to get into that room and reprioritize and change the programming, then we're pretty well going to have to be slaves the rest of our lives to that programming, the way we've been slaves this part of our lives to it. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to reprogram. We're trying to change what's in the room. Now, if what we want to try to do is bypass the conscious mind and go directly into the subconscious, what's that called? Subliminal. That's the very definition of the word subliminal. Stimulus that is perceived by the subconscious mind, but not perceived by the conscious mind. And so that's why we're working so hard in subliminal, because we believe it's the most powerful human development tool available to us now. We think probably what we're doing now is a Model A, but it's far superior to any way I've found to lose weight. because I always tried to attack the problem on a physical level, and this is a way to attack it where the real root cause of the problem is, those real preferences and those emotional tendencies to solve them with food and the low self-image that are contained in the subconscious mind. And so here's what we do. Our company manufactures a cassette tape, an audio cassette that looks like any other cassette. And as you listen to this tape, all you're consciously aware of hearing are the sound of ocean waves. Listen intently as you want to, that's all you can hear. But embedded down in those waves, recorded on that same tape at a little bit lower volume than the waves, are multiple tracks of voices. Not just one voice, but lots of voices that bombard your subconscious mind with wonderful, encouraging, powerful, positive pieces of information. Voices that are telling you continually, thousands of times an hour, that food is losing its importance. That your body and your health and being fit and trim and attractive is more important to you than food. That you don't solve emotional problems with eating. That you can lead a happy, healthy life without overeating. And that you deserve to be a thin, healthy person. And then we go one step further. Then we found that if we take affirmations that take an assumptive end result, that desired result we're looking for, and speak of it as though it were present tense, you are a trim, fit, healthy, attractive person who takes pride in your body. You see, if we put those messages in there, we found that if we put messages of you're becoming healthy and fit and trim, you're becoming a thin person, the subconscious says, well, okay, when we get thin, let me know, and I'll start acting like a thin person. But if we say you are thin, then when that programming, see, the subconscious will believe anything it's put in there. That's why it works on all that terrible programming that's in there now. And so if we can convince the subconscious that you are a thin, healthy person, then when you look in the mirror and see those extra pounds, you have the same reaction that Miss America did. Remember, that violent reaction she had was because the image she saw in the mirror didn't conform to the image she had in her mind of her present self-image. And ladies and gentlemen, your subconscious mind will see to it that you begin a behavior and continue in a behavior that makes this body in the mirror conform to the image you have of it in your mind. It's just that simple. And I can tell you from experience, and the thousands of people across the country who've experienced these tapes can tell you that once your mind gets right, once you really do feel that you deserve to be thin, once your self-image raises up and now you're more important than the food, once you start to replace the food with other things that are healthier, and once you stop solving those emotional problems with food instead of other people and relationship and real things like love, it gets easy. Staying away from food can be easy. The subliminal tapes that we manufacture have been in use, and an awful lot of people have used them for a long time. But I'm really excited to tell you that we have a brand new set of weight loss tapes that use a new recording technique, a very sophisticated technique that we don't believe anyone else has ever tried. First of all, our new weight loss tape looks like the other one, but it's much more effective. Positive of some of the affirmations from each of these three, but folks, this is the most powerful weight loss set of tapes we've ever come up with. I recommend that you use the rotational series if you have a severe weight problem, a lot of weight to lose, or if you just have real bad eating habits. On the tape are just going to lose interest in food. You're going to find yourself reading health and nutrition books. You're going to find yourself starting an exercise program because you're going to become more interested in your body than you are in food. You're going to find yourself satisfied easier. You're going to find yourself very aware of how much you're eating. And once that happens to you, it's easy. You see, all you have to do is change those priorities, what you really want out of life, what's really important to you, and then you don't have all those nagging thoughts. You don't have all of those decisions that get made that are decisions that you wish you hadn't have made. Well, the vast majority of you, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get some help from the tape. You see, you're going to continue to do the same thing you've done all your life. All of your life long, you've done the best you could to take the weight off and keep it off. But your best hasn't been good enough. Well, you're going to get some help from this tape, and it's going to start to get easier. And the food will be a little bit easier to turn away, and you'll be able to diminish how much you eat a little bit at a time. And then one wonderful day, your best is now good enough. And then it's downhill from that point. And then you start having a pride and a dignity and a good feeling about yourself just for being in control. And pretty soon, you're going to find yourself eating properly, not because you want to lose the weight. You see, losing weight is really not a real good motivation to eat properly. Because once the weight's gone, the motivation's gone. What your motivation needs to be is to become normal, to become healthy here and here, to be a person in control, a person who determines their own behavior and does what's right for them and has a chance to live life to its fullest, feeling good about themselves with their priorities where they belong. That's what the tapes can do for you. These tapes will set you free from food, some of you quickly, some of you it'll take longer. I think you'll find that there's a delightful experience ahead of you, and I'm here to tell you that life that's free from the bondage of food and the constant thoughts of food and food taking control of your self-image and of your body, life free of that is really a pretty neat life to live. Thank you. We appreciate you coming. Thank you. God bless and good luck on your weight loss. Thank you.
Hi, this is Joel Land. You know, you can reprogram your relationship with food using subliminal tapes, too. In fact, the subliminal tapes that I talked about in this speech, the ones that have helped me and thousands of others lose lots of weight and keep it off, are available to you. You also come with a full money-back, 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If, after listening to the tapes for 30 days, you don't feel that they're changing your food priorities, your attitude, and your relationship toward food, if you don't see some changes in your eating habits, if you're not losing weight naturally and effortlessly, then simply return the tapes, and I'll return every weight loss tapes are effortless to use. In fact, you don't even listen to them. You just allow them to play at a very low volume as background for your life. You can go about any activity. You can read the newspaper, watch television, work, carry on a conversation. Subliminal tapes will be there, reprogramming your subconscious mind. You don't listen to them because they're not a conscious activity. The waves are all you'll be able to hear on a conscious level, but your subconscious mind will hear and be influenced by those powerful subliminal messages that are designed to diminish the importance of food and raise the importance of you and your body, your health, and your attractiveness. I hope you'll order those subliminal tapes. It's an awful lot of people, and I believe they'll help you. You sure don't have anything to lose. You can order your tapes by calling toll-free 1-800-533-LAND. That's 533-5263. And God bless.